Good evening, everybody. This is James McCanny with my Science Hour for February 11th, 2021. And tonight I'll be talking about some interesting things that happened this past week and putting them into perspective, and then some analysis, the kind of analysis that you will not hear anyplace else on the planet, guaranteed. But at any rate, a couple things happened this week. What were they? In India, and let me preface this whole thing by talking about the Paris Climate Accord. What was the Paris Climate Accord? It was a scam to get the United States to pay a lot of money based on carbon tax and make the United States feel guilty by the woke people to make you feel guilty that you were using carbon-based fuels. Okay, sounds good. But then it allowed China and India, the two prolific generators of carbon dioxide on the planet, to build as many coal-burning plants as they wanted to. There were absolutely no restrictions on them at all. And that's, in fact, what happened this year. So they would take money literally from the United States and give it to China and India so they could build more coal power plants. That's what it says. That's what it says. And so anybody that's really woke, and of course they didn't read the Paris, all they think about, it's the same thing as superficial feel-good science. It sounds wonderful. It's like really gets you excited, but when you read between the lines... Well, actually, if you just read the lines, you find out that it's a political football to take down the United States. Everything is to take down the United States because you cannot have a one-world government with a powerful country, with a single powerful country. You got to bring everybody down to the same level. So I just wanted to preface these two stories with the truth about the Paris Climate Accord baloney. Okay, so anyway, this week up in the Himalayan mountains in India, they had a dam. They had a dam that broke due to a glacier melting. So there was a glacier that melted, and they were building this dam. And the dam filled up with water and burst and blew out, and this tremendous cascade of water came down, took out a big bridge, etc., killing 170 people, they think. I mean, it's, you know, those type of deals. How do you count 170 people when this massive amount of water comes down the hillside? There's little towns built along this river. You know, they don't know how many people died. It could have been 8,000. They say 170, and that's typical to try and minimize the disaster, and that's to minimize the culpability of the morons who were trying to build this thing in the first place. But here's the thing. When you build a dam, you need granite rock on the side of the dam where the dam meets the land, so to speak. Okay, you're putting this cement barricade up, and it has to have footings that are on both sides of it, because there's an unbelievable amount of pressure on this thing. You're holding back an entire, 100 and 150 feet deep of water. So there's tremendous amount of force on this cement wall. So it has to have footings that are in rock. When I looked at this thing, you could see that it was like mud. And there was a similar case in South America about a year ago where they were building a dam. And these are fairly sizable dams to create electricity, and that's the point that I'm going to get to here, is because these third world countries are trying desperately to build something to create energy. And so, this was up in the mountains in the Himalayas in India, but they had no footings. There was nothing to hook this dam into, so when the water came and filled up the dam, it, adios amigo. It went away and took out this facility, and they'll never be able to rebuild this thing. There were just some pilings. When you saw what this water did when it took out the dam, there were a couple pilings left. Nothing. nothing left of this dam. The dam just completely was blown away and taken down this ravine, and where it went through, it took out a bridge that crossed the ravine, etc. A tremendous amount of water just went down this ravine at one time. Okay, so now let's go over to China. Number two country in the number one of the two countries in the Paris Peace Accord that would benefit greatly. They built more coal power plants in 2020 than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. China is building and building, trying to get up to the level of industrialization of the United States. And of course, the Three Rivers Dam there is a major, major, major project. I mean, it is a massive dam. And typically when you build a dam, you shouldn't have it very wide. And that's the problem with the Three Rivers Dam, is that it's so wide. And then what they did is they finished it and they said, well, we want to put more water in this dam. So then they had to take and scrape the top of the dam and put rods down in it, steel rods, to try and attach another piece on top. And if you know anything about a dam, you pour it all at one time. All that cement has to be poured so that it's still liquid when the new cement is coming in on the top. For example, the Hoover Dam, they poured cement until the thing was done. You could not stop pouring cement. And that's what they did in China. So now you have a fissure in right through the middle of the dam, a tremendous structural mistake. But be that as it may, China has built more coal plant power in the last year, in 2020, than all of the rest of the world combined. And yet they're in the Paris Peace Accord and nobody's saying a word about them. And so if you know somebody that's a global climate change activist and believe that we should be in the Paris Climate Accord, they're people that don't know what they're talking about, because it's not to protect the world or the planet. It allows China and India to build as much pollution as they want. But moreover, this is the world trying desperately to produce more energy, and they need energy to develop their industries. And a lot of the industry in China is, it all depends on electricity, whether it's clothes, whether it's electronics, whether it's metal working, whether it's mining. It all depends on electricity. They're heavily dependent on electricity, like any modern country. But the idea is that they are trying to desperately to build up the electrical power generation industry to get more energy to build and you have to understand, for every ounce of energy they produce, that demands resources of some kind to then make into products. So driving the economy, is this where the planet should be going? You have to step back a few steps, a few paces. And it's always an assumption that we have to drive the economy. That's the driving force, when nobody's really managing resources, nobody's really managing other factors that are essential to the future of the world, basically the future populations of the world. So the ruling class is an insane class. And the other thing is, they're very stupid people. They're people that walk around with suits on, and you might assume that they know something, which is really not the case at all. The real thing they're there for is to create a mask, to create a facade, to pretend like something is really going on there. Okay, so next I want to talk a little bit about California. I said I had two topics, really I had three. And so they're trying to become energy independent, and they make a claim that 20% of their energy last year came from renewable energy. And so that's really the numbers lie, let's just put it that way. But we all know that California was experiencing blackouts. Their infrastructure But once again, you have government trying to regulate utilities, and with broad strokes, broad paintbrush strokes of edicts, like we're going to become 100% independent by such and such a date, not having any clue what that really means. A good example, the state of Hawaii passed a law stating that by a certain year, which has already passed, they had to have a certain percentage of ethanol in their gasoline, ethanol being a so-called green fuel, which it's really not. But the point is that they had to have a certain percentage of ethanol. Well, they didn't have the ability to produce the ethanol on this remote Pacific island chain. So they had to import it at greater cost than gasoline. And just the cost of moving the ethanol there was more than the pollution was more than what it would have taken to just to burn gasoline in the first place. So you have politicians making edicts, you know, pounding their chest, making themselves look good when they really don't know what they're doing. This is an issue, too. I just had an issue with a company that supports some of the things I do. And all of a sudden, goofy stuff started to happen, double billing, just a laundry list of things. And this is a company I've dealt with for literally decades. And all of a sudden, all this stuff starts happening. I said, what did you get a new MBA for in charge of your company? You know, their web pages changed. They had this ugly color that was on the web page. And I mean, it was just one thing after the other, really stupid things going on. Yeah. And so what you'd got was new management that came in, and they were going to, okay, well, we're going to put this thing over here and that thing over there, and we're going to move this up there, and we're going to take this person and put down there. They had to do something to make it look like they were doing something, but they, in the process, they messed all everything up that was a fine-tuned, well-working machine, a business process that was going on for decades, and all of a sudden it went topsy-turvy because somebody got in charge and thought they were going to change, and in their view, this is the thing also with, like, say, the Green New Deal. Here you have people who've never run a Kool-Aid stand on the corner as a little kid, never had any negotiation with business of any kind, and all of a sudden, here they are trying to make sweeping proposals for entire countries and the world based on in what I would call scientific fear science. This is what's going on. So you have the fear of global climate change. You have the fear of you know, whatever it is, the fear de jure. And then you have politicians coming in, make like they're going to make these sweeping changes and everything's going to be better. And that's the classic formula for disaster. Because you can't take... In fact, there's a term, it's called ship shape. It's a very interesting term, and it has a lot of ramifications, and it comes from the old sailing days. Here you have a ship that's 200 feet long. It's got 50 working sails. It has all kinds of ropes that are coming here and there, fore and aft, and each one has its operation, and if one of those gets tangled with another one, then the ship is going to sink. Literally, you can have, if you had one sail pulling on another and you come into port and the lines get tangled up and you start crashing into other stuff, or you're out at sea and you're trying to manage this boat, it needs to be very well in order. The everything on there has a purpose, and everything there has been placed in an exact place to do an exact thing. And so all of your sailors need to know this. They have to know the boat they're on. The boat over there is not the same as the boat over here. All of the lines are different. If you've ever been on an ocean-going sailboat, a modern one, they're pretty well designed. The architect takes care of all of that for you so you don't have the jib sheet and the main sail sheet getting tangled up. or you have different blocks to tension the sales, etc. You have all of that is put together. But in an economy, a country that's as complicated as the United States, with all of the hundreds of thousands of different businesses with interdependencies, like the food business, that's why the restaurants couldn't open up again. Well, they could open their door, but they couldn't get product to cook, to have in their restaurant. The supply chains had been broken. The warehouse where you would get, a restaurant has probably 50 different supply houses, one for napkins and paperware, one for dishes to resupply the dishes that get worn out or broken, they have all of these supply chains that are dependent, and if one is missing, they don't have a business. And this developed over time as that restaurant started out as a small business and grew. They developed more dependencies on suppliers. And all of this gets shut down, and then you say, oh, we're going to get back to normal. Hey, let me tell you something, boys and girls. There isn't any new normal. Now would be a good time to get into the restaurant business. Land is cheap. You could start out with a basic restaurant and start out with a basic supply chain, maybe sell one product and then build up over time and start that over again. But for an existing restaurant that had its clientele, the clientele aren't there anymore. The clientele stopped going there. And once you stop, you put the brakes on that clientele going to the given restaurant, it isn't there anymore. And so I'm just kind of giving some other examples here, but you take something as complicated as the energy industry, and you have idiot governors and presidents and people that just have no idea. They're making broad, sweeping strokes of policy and hoping that somehow that makes things better. But come back to the whole issue of energy, and I'm going to make a statement here. I've developed the wing generator. I'm going to preface it with this. I developed the wing generator, of course, to hopefully solve the world energy problem. But when you step back and look at it, I don't want to solve the world energy problem. Because people talk about fusion or thorium, the new fusion systems of creating energy, infinite energy, we'd have all the energy we needed. You don't want that. You don't want a world with an infinite amount of usable energy, because what are you going to use the energy on? Well, you need resources. You need materials. You need materials to create the basic raw materials that then you use in the manufacturing and then create products. And so where does it end? How far does this go to the point where you've used up all of the resources in the world and there's just no more? And then all of a sudden, gee, isn't it great to have all this energy, but you don't have any resources to put into the process? And, of course, it comes back to, can you eat a better steak? Can you have a better ear of corn? And, that's where things have been going with the Monsantos of the world. Bayer buying Monsanto, etc. Their goal is to try and make things efficient. If you've ever driven through Kansas or Nebraska in harvest season for corn, you see just endless corn, farm after farm, 1,000-acre farm after 1,000-acre farm, just with the corn growing up. And it's interesting because as the farm started to fail, you'd come along and all of a sudden there'd be, who knows, a few hundred acres, 1,000 acres of nothing, not even a weed growing. This is in August or September or October. Where you're at the heart of harvest season, and it's called canopy corn. That means that every square inch of canopy is covered in absorbing sunlight. That's called canopy. It's a term used in corn production, in corn growing. And the corn is in canopy, And then you come along and there's, you know, 1,000 acres with nothing, not even a, there's maybe out in the middle a little weed that's struggling to grow. That's because all of that corn is Roundup ready. It lives through Roundup and everything else dies. They have killed the land. There's no ability to grow there, and there won't be for 100 years. And that's the Monsanto plan to make everything, you know, I don't know what their plan is. It's pretty ridiculous. I went one time to an island, and there was all of this corn growing there, and it had signs, et cetera, you know, little signs Monsanto. And so I went to a farmer's garden, or farmer's market, I'm sorry, a farmer's market, to buy some food, and I didn't see any corn. And I said, you know, how come nobody's selling corn? You got these massive fields of corn all over this island. And they said, oh, that's Monsanto. That's seed corn. That's where they grow their seed to sell. And you can't even walk onto that land. They'll shoot you. That's Monsanto. They purchased islands to grow their seed corn. And it takes a tremendous amount of water, so the limited amount of water on the island is completely dedicated to Monsanto, and the people don't have a drop of water to take a shower in or flush a toilet. You know, anyway, things get kind of out of whack. Let's just put it that way. And the world right now is way out of whack. But the only thing you can say is there's some good things that came out of COVID, like the schools closing down. And the universities, just bastions of insanity, of just, you know, ridiculous concepts, because the people that worked in these schools have never been out of the school system. They got their degree, they became a teacher, or they got their PhD, they then went off and became a university professor. They've never been in the real world. They don't know anything. This is the seats of knowledge being run by people that don't know anything. They're textbook geniuses, I call them. And so, at any rate, this is the same way with the energy industry. The energy industry has grown from nothing. In the 1800s, there was no energy industry. There was no energy industry at all. As far as the overall view of the economy of, say, the first world countries, which would have included the United States at that point, because it was developing cities, it had electricity, things like that. Tesla was starting out in the late 1800s installing electricity. Westinghouse came in and bought the equipment, basically the patents, etc., and started installing electricity. But in the 1800s, there was no such industry. There was no oil industry. There was no uranium industry. There was no natural gas industry. There was a little bit of coal industry, but it was like, you know, bringing it in on horseback. None of these industries existed 100 years ago, literally. They have all grown up because of the need for energy. And it's very clear that energy became controlled in the early 1900s by the J.P. Morgans. That's why they shut Tesla down. It's one of the big kind of hidden secrets. The reason they shut Tesla down was because they knew he was extracting energy from the atmosphere, and it was, in a sense, a free source of energy. They shut him down and then created an excuse for what he was doing. They were saying, oh, no, he was transmitting energy. Well, where was he getting the energy to transmit? That story doesn't hold water at all, but it's still repeated today. Okay, so anyway, that was a little bit of preface to what I was going to say. My main point here is that we don't want to solve the world energy problem. We want to be able to provide a limited amount of energy on a regular basis from a natural source that allows people to live a comfortable life and stop the use of what are totally erroneously called fossil fuels. They're not fossil fuels. They're not made from fossils. They're not made from, all the oil in the world is not made from dinosaur bones. I'm really sorry to have to tell you that, boys and girls and grandmas and grandpas. How absolutely absurd fossil fuels to imagine that these fuels came from dinosaur bones. I mean, if you believe in the Easter Bunny, if you believe in Santa Claus, then you can believe in fossil fuels. Okay, but they are there. Where did they come from? The coal came from big tsunamis that took tremendous amount of plant material and piled it up in a given place. Tsunamis. That's where they came from. And the difference between clean coal and dirty coal is that the tsunamis that created the clean coal did not have an associated comet causing that tsunami. Or the tsunami came at when the Earth was not embedded in the tail of the comet, in which you got a tremendous influx of what the ancients called naphtha, the oil. The burning naphtha was oil, petroleum. That's where it came from. And so some coal beds got infused with tremendous amounts of oil. That's the dirty coal. And some of the coal did not get infused with hydrocarbons from comet tail when the comet was passing. But once again, government, let's just make some rules here, kind of like the commandments of energy. Government should not be in charge of energy and energy distribution, etc. Government should regulate the companies. We have to go back to the public utility model, having private companies, Enron, in charge of energy. It's only got one way to go, and that's corruption, absolute corruption and deception and the public not getting good energy. That's what's going on right now. You're not getting good, reliable energy. You're paying a premium for it, and there's nobody watching the ship. It's just very simple. We could, by turning off lights and just conserving energy, electric energy, we could reduce our nuclear power plants to zero overnight, simply by conserving energy, not leaving the lights on. Having lights in a city that are based on, movement, motion detector lights, so that not all of the lights are on in the city. About one-third of the United States power goes to lighting. That's a fact. And it's gone down a bit because of LED lighting, but then you still have all the industrial lighting, etc. One-third of our energy budget for electricity goes to lighting. And about 7% of the electricity comes from nuclear power plants. So just by conserving a little bit of turning the lights off when you're not in the room, you could help shut down nuclear power plants, which are a disaster. People are calling nuclear power plants green energy now because it doesn't produce CO2, allegedly. It does produce CO2. But not as much as burning coal, etc. But nuclear fuel is the worst horrific pollutant ever devised by man. It is not green. This is a marketing campaign being pushed by General Electric and Siemens to try and convince public to go back to that good old, on that good old Ronnie Reagan nuclear power. Oh my goodness, did that get sold to the public like a just like candy to kids on TV. Oh my goodness. So anyway, the government cannot control power. Also, what about third world countries? Can third world countries and second world countries come up to the level of energy usage as the United States? And the answer is no. The United States per capita uses something like 16 times the amount of energy as people in other countries. You go to other countries and people maybe have one light in the house, one light that sheds enough light for people to move around, etc. They might not have refrigeration. If they do, they're lucky. Remember back in the 50s, the United States went down to help Puerto Rico, bring it out of the 1950s third world country age, which was, a lot of poverty in Puerto Rico. So what they did is they called it Operation Bootstrap. And what they did is they provided electricity. They went in and invested in electrical service, although minimally, so that everybody could have a light bulb in the house. And then also refrigerators, because this is the tropics. Food does not last long if it's not refrigerated. Fruit, meat, other things. So you didn't have, even if you could get meat, you had to eat it that day. Or if you got fish, you had to eat it that day. If there were any leftovers, there was no way to save it. You could maybe make a stew and then eat part of it tomorrow, but that was the extent. There was no refrigeration, meant poor hygiene, etc. There was not good water, fresh water, etc. So anyway, Operation Bootstrap was to provide, one of the biggest things it did was provide refrigerators. This is in a third world country, and Puerto Rico is still struggling to become just a modernized state with large overpopulation issue in the high concentration areas. You might not know this, but San Juan, Puerto Rico, has the highest density population in the world. If you can compare it to China and India, the big cities there, San Juan, Puerto Rico has a higher density population because it's just a little area and all the people continue to live there and have children, etc. It's the highest population density, not the highest population density in the world, which is hard to imagine even, given like Japan and China and India. And other countries like Africa, the third world countries tend to have very high concentration population in the cities. And a lot of places, no place to go, like Mexico City. I used to live there. And it's like it's the bowl of an ancient volcano. It's the caldera of an ancient volcano. When the Aztecs were there, it was a lake bed. And they built causeways and they grew their crops, etc., with the water that was in the lake. And when the Spanish came, that's what it was like. It was like a lake. And now it's dried up. But there's no place to grow. And so it grew to become the largest city in the world. When I was there, early 1970s, it was neck and neck with Tokyo to be the biggest city in the world. And then Mexico City just exploded in population. Outpopulated even Tokyo. And in 10 years, by 1980, it had doubled its population. Mexico City had doubled its population to 20 million people in 10 years. That's just, you know, unbelievable expansion of population. And so, when you look at that, it's another issue. I've talked about that in previous radio shows. The expanse of population in, for example, Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador, population growth there, and now this is a statistics that I was, I study statistics, mathematics, election statistics, etc. But population statistics, if the countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador continued to have people come into the United States at the rate they were doing, 140,000 per month. That's what there were, the number of people entering the United States before the Trump era. They could do that forever. It's not relieving their population. Their population is not going down. That would just take the excess population that's being generated. They have 100, in those three countries, they have 140,000 people being born every month. So if you're taking 140,000 out of there and putting them into the United States every month, you're maintaining your population there, but you can keep supplying that 140,000 per month forever. Do you understand that? In Mexico, being the most populous country in Latin America and also being on our border, can keep sending in 1 million people per year unabated forever. That's beyond recognizable. The United States, in no country would have, even India and China would not have the ability to absorb with their huge populations, would not have the ability to absorb that many people over an extended period of time, basically going on for to infinity. So the question coming back to energy is, how do you supply energy to these greatly increasing population growth? And there are places like Sierra Leone in Africa that have more than doubling the maximum growth rate that typically is observed in third world countries is a 7% growth per year. And what that does, if you compound that, that's where you get up to a doubling of your population in a 10-year period. And so if you go from, you double your population every 10 years, that means in 20 years, you're going to have four times as many. In another 10 years, you're going to have eight times as many people. And so, like, in one generation, you're going to increase your population in your country by eight times, if you can imagine that. The United States now is entering an epoch in which it's having exponential growth. And this is the issue. You know, the issue with immigrants and immigration, etc., is not about who's coming in now. It's about the population growth. And, of course, there is an issue with people coming in who have no medical history, no medical records. They have tuberculosis. You're mixing them into the general population. Now with COVID, you don't know. I mean, these countries had no lockdown. They had no social distancing, etc. So you don't know who's coming in with disease. And just to open up the door and let everybody come in while you're having the entire local population lockdown is just beyond absurd. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. But what makes sense anymore anyway? But the idea that the United States is heading into an era where a part of its population is having exponential growth. And that is, remember, in the third world countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico, Sierra Leone, where Sierra Leone has passed the doubling every 10 years, and a number of other countries in Africa have doubled in 10 years, and the growth rate continues in India and China. They're neck and neck growing to where they're going to double their population within the next 10 to 15 years. You know, so the exponential growth in world population, that's one issue. How do you provide food for all of these people? And electricity. And then the question is, can they all come to the United States? And, well, I don't know. Bring them on and then see what happens. That's all I can say. That's what the belief is now. And there again, like I say, this is being done by people who have never run a little kid's Kool-Aid stand on the corner. They've never run a business. They've been in politics all their life. You know, they've received a paycheck. They live in gated communities. They make a lot of money. They don't see, you know, during the lockdowns, they kept getting their paycheck while they're out pontificating over what everybody else should do. But back to the idea of energy, with the explosive world population and understanding that probably maybe about 7% of the world has access to electricity where they can just turn on the switch and there's plenty of electricity, the washing machine, the dishwasher. Dishwashers take a tremendous amount of energy. And by the way, just a caveat, when I spec out systems for people for the wing generator, I tell people, you're not going to be living like you used to. You're going to have to put in geothermal heat. You're going to have to, you're not going to have a dishwasher. Because the dishwasher takes water and it heats it up to like steaming hot, just below boiling point, and that takes energy. Heating water takes a lot of energy. There's a lot of mass there that you have to heat up, and that takes a lot of energy. Or electric water heaters for your house, or electric cooking, or electric oven. That you're not going to be doing with wind energy. So you have to convert your lifestyle, and if you, say, are buying an old home or buying even an existing home that's maybe modern, a lot of them are set up for primarily electricity, especially in the southern states. You have electric heating and air conditioning. You don't have a gas service. for heating or for your stove. Everything is electric. Air conditioning takes a tremendous amount of electricity. So then, the question is, if you look at the usage of coal, you look at the use of natural gas and the production of these and nuclear power, etc., is the entire world going to become electrified to the level of the first world countries? And that's the assumption. That is the assumption with everybody that is out there, that somehow, you know, we can keep this thing going. And one of the flaws also of the Trump administration, of which there were some, I will admit it, although the there was, I'm not going to get into politics here, but was that we can keep using energy at the rate we're using it. And of course, the United States did have available energy. There's no question about it. In fact, the United States became an exporter of energy. But and Trump was right about alternative energy. Solar and three-blade wind turbines don't work. His quip that, honey, can't watch TV tonight, the wind's not blowing, is true. Because it's a bad design. The three-blade wind turbines are simply a bad design. The little ones work okay, up to, say, 10 kilowatts, but that's not going to power your country. And the reason the little ones work is because they spin fast. The big ones don't spin fast, so the wind blows right through them. I mean, very, very simple. This is third grade science here, boys and girls, yet it has escaped General Electric and all their engineers and management and all the government agencies that put money into this garbage. And the same with solar. You know, you're not going to power a country on solar power. You're not going to power your house with solar power. That's any kind of reasonable cost. If you gave away the solar panels, you would still not be able to power your house with solar panels because of the battery issue. You have to have 7 times the amount of solar panels on an average. This is in Phoenix, Arizona. Say you want to take a house in Phoenix, Arizona. You want to power that house 24/7 with solar panels. Not only do you need the energy right now for solar panels, but you need there are what they call solar hours, which means your solar panels are producing 100% of the time, 100% of their capacity. Okay, so at around 16%, then what you need is 6 times the number of solar panels just to power your house right now. Then you need another 6 times that because you have to run charge batteries, and they're inefficient. They're about 80% to charge and to discharge. You lose another 20%. So if you calculate all this out, to power a house, you would need to cover about 1/4 acre of land with solar panels. And then your batteries would run you a few $100,000. And so you're talking to provide a house with solar panel energy that'll actually do the job. We're talking $250,000 investment. And could you do it? Yeah, you could do it. For $250,000, probably the price of your house. You know, if you lived in a $250,000 house in Phoenix and you wanted to power it with electricity, it would cost you $250,000 just to have the solar panels, the batteries, the hookup. And then it would be a fire hazard because you have all these low voltage, high current connections. Okay, so at any rate, back to the idea of powering the world and providing energy to this, you know, right now I believe there's closer to 10 billion people in the world. I've said that before on the air. And they talk about 11 million illegal aliens in the United States. No, there's that many in East LA. So we were talking probably close to 40 to 50 million illegal aliens in the United States. And those are from, typically, the majority are from Mexico and northern Central America, the 3 countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Here's another fun fact. I've talked about this on the air, that between the United States, the official censorship or census, I'm sorry, the official census of the United States, you are pushing about 350 million people. Mexico has 150 million people that, you know, 8 years ago, 6 years ago, it was 100 million, 104 million, I should say. That was the official count in the last previous census. And so given that Mexico easily has 150 million people, you add those two together, Mexico and the United States, by the way, the United States is the third most populous country in the world. It was like China or India, whichever one is first today. Those are number one and number two. United States is third. Nobody else holds a candle. The United States has like 350 million people. They are third. But if you combine Mexico and the United States, you have a half a billion people there. And that's when you hit the knee of the exponential curve, which is going to go off the charts. And that's what it's doing. You're going to have in 10 years, by 2030, you know, people talk about the electric, you know, by 2030, we want to be independent. Well, with the electricity growth that is projected, even if the population didn't grow, but now if you have the doubling of that population, you have Mexico, United States in 2030 with a billion people. If you can imagine that. That's what's going on, boys and girls. Your country, the United States, combined with Mexico, whether you draw a border there and keep them on one side or the other or whatever, the raw statistics, Mexico and the United States, half a billion people today, 2030, it's going to have a billion people, in those two countries. It's just, I mean, there's nobody driving the ship. This ship is without a rudder and without a captain. I don't know how much more I can explain this to you. And it comes back to energy, water, food, resources, etc. So could you drive a Trump economy forever? Could you get into that ship and say, we are going to, you know, make America great again? That's a good theme. And it worked. It was thumping. That economy was rolling. And it was hitting records never ever seen before in the world. But the question is, how long is that balloon going to grow before it explodes? The resources, etc. I mean, to maintain that. But I've often said, too, that the real flaw in the Trump agenda was that he had no wars. And this is not from my perspective. This is from the perspective of the people that make money off war. I don't make money off of war. Never did, never will. But the people who make money off of war, the people that control the government, and that includes the pharmaceutical industry, by the way, too. They are big in the military. All the military people get their shots, and they get their treatment as the shots have their effect on these people. Talk about guinea pigs. People in the military are the original guinea pigs of pharmaceuticals. They test all their stuff on the military and people in third world countries. But back to the original theme. Could you run a Trump economy forever, a pre-COVID Trump economy? Could you run it forever? And the answer is no. It would come tumbling down at some point because of resource issues. But let me complete the point I was making about the military, is that Trump put money into the military like nobody had ever done before. When Obama left office, the military was in shambles. They had been using that equipment since the year 2000, since 9/11. They'd been using all that military equipment to the point where it was just not even functional anymore. They couldn't repair the airplanes anymore. There was no new buildup of, they were just using all the same, the F-16s, et cetera. They were using all these old military aircraft, and they were just, you know, they wear out like a car. There's a point in which, okay, it's time for this guy to go to the junkyard. That's what the state of the military was. So Trump built it up again. But And that kind of appeased the military-industrial complex for about 3 years. But then they hit the point and they said, hey, we're not dropping bombs. We're not maintaining these military aircraft. When you purchase a military aircraft for, say, $40 million, $120 million is in the maintenance of that craft, in the support and everything else that goes with it, in the extra parts, all the replacement parts. It's like your automobile. If you buy a new shock or a new like hub for your automobile, it's going to cost you three times what it would cost the factory to put it in originally in the first place. That's why they make a lot of their money is on spare parts. That's why they can sell you the car with not a lot of profit, because they make all their money on maintenance and after expenses. That's where the money comes from. That's like a lot of businesses do that. But at any rate, the military-industrial complex finally woke up and says, hey, we're not making our money. You know, sure, we're getting the build-up and we're selling, but then this military equipment is not being used. You got to drop bombs. You got to fire rockets. You got to blow stuff up. You know, and there's going to be some collateral damage. Some people are going to die, including some of ours. But that's the way they make their money. And so Trump wasn't doing that for them. Trump wasn't getting into wars. He was pulling the military back. And you know, they had built up a, you know, decades and decades of expectancy on these foreign wars for the use of this military equipment. So that's my estimate of what really happened to Trump, is that he had enemies. And the first thing that happened when he was on the way out is the military started going to Congress and going, oh, we got this problem in Syria. We got this problem. We still got to be in Afghanistan. Doggone it. You know, on and on, where we got to keep this military presence because of the honor of the United States and democracy and everything else under the sun. And what they're doing is the generals are salespeople for the military-industrial complex. They got to get the wars going so that the military-industrial complex makes its money. And that you got to use that equipment for them to make money. You got to be dropping bombs, firing rockets, shooting guns, whatever it is. You got to be out there doing maneuvers, you know. You got to be using that equipment up so they get their maintenance money. And so I think they realized that another 4 years of Trump without war wasn't going to cut it. So they had to get Trump out of there. So just watch, before too long, the military will, and the Biden administration will have wars going on. That's just the bottom line. I mean, you can already see it going on. But anyway, and those are all crafted wars, by the way. These are all designer wars, let's put it that way. Designed to drop bombs, make the people at home think that they're really defending the country and democracy and the right of man and, you know, human rights, whatever they want to call it. But, you know, it's to make the military-industrial complex profitable again. Okay, so anyway, getting back to energy, this whole idea of energy. And now let me pose a question here, and it's kind of a, I'm going to have to craft my answer so it's not misinterpreted. So the question is, can the world, let me just ask it this way, can the world produce enough energy from wind? It's certainly not going to from solar. That ain't going to work. Can it produce enough energy from wind with the JMCC wing generator to power the world? And the answer is, there is no system of energy that can power the world with everybody to the level of the first world countries. It's just not going to happen. It's like not everybody in the world can have toilet paper. Sorry, there's just not enough trees. And it's the same kind of thing. But turning it around, you could nicely, very nicely power third world countries with the wing generator and bring them up to a level that was acceptable, where they would have refrigeration, electric transportation, non-polluting types of transportation, etc., electrical transportation, and they would get along quite nicely. I've had offers from India, for example, to put systems around the country because they have something like, I don't know, well, I won't even go into details on some of these offers, but they're enormous. To somehow bring electricity into the far reaches of India, because much of it is without power, without reliable power for sure. But this is the entire world. And so they have a lot of wind there. There's a lot of places, especially around the coastal areas where some of the big population areas are, and around the world, where they have very good wind. So you could bring the third world populations up two or three notches with the wing generator, and that, I hope, happens soon, and it starts happening. The other thing, the wing generator I'm using right now promoting for farms and ranches, and I have the models from 2 kilowatts to 250 kilowatts, and so farms and ranches can become energy independent, so they can keep their operation running if the lights go out. And so anyway, to do this, there's a questionnaire on my webpage. You just follow to the wing generator subpage, and at the bottom of that page, there's a questionnaire to fill out to get the process started. But the other question is, can the United States power its current electrical needs and also absorb all of the new energy requirement coming along with electrical cars coming up? And that the answer is yes, it could do that. With not that many wing generators. And so anyway, I see this coming. It's something that is so pressing, and the power companies are in such dire financial straits that the acceptance of this is going to be forced on them. 5-10 years ago, it would not have happened. Now it's something that's being forced on them just by the economic situation, etc. So I hope you found this show a bit informative. I've kind of talked through a number of topics, specific incidents. Remember, I started out talking about the China dam, or I'm sorry, the China building more coal-fired power plants last year than all the rest of the world combined. Tremendous amount of pollution, trying to produce energy, desperately produce energy to keep their industries fueled. And then the dam breaking in the Himalayas in India, these third world countries trying desperately to build anything that will produce energy, and very bad engineering. That dam in Himalayas, that was going to go anyway. They had mud where the dam was interfacing with the land around it. They had mud. This baby was going to go eventually, and they didn't even get it done before it blew out. So at any rate, there's another case where India has good wind in many places and could provide very good power from wind. And in the case of the United States, my book, McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, has a section in there. It's called Distributed Energy, How You Build Up the Infrastructure of Wing Generators So We Could Power Our Needs with the wind. And so the majority of our energy would come, not all of it, you would not want all of it coming from the wind, but we could shut down the nuclear plants, most of the coal plants, and run on natural gas to top off the part that doesn't come from the wind. Anyway, remember my webpage, a lot of things there, the grow towers, the water filtration products, the wing generator, the education programs, trying to keep you out of the dark ages. JMCCSCI.com, the webpage JMCCSCI.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.